If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorn. Marcus Aurelius is not an easy figure to categorise. Described as one of Rome's five good emperors, he also became notorious for the persecution of Christians. Though renowned for his philosophical writing, he spent much of his reign engaged in military campaigning. In the June issue of BBC History Magazine, Dr. Sushma Malik of Roehampton University explores Marcus Aurelius's remarkable career. And that's the subject of today's conversation with the magazine's editor, Rob Attar.
A few months ago, we spoke on this podcast about Nero, who I suppose is the archetypal bad emperor, and you argued then for viewing him in a more nuanced way. Today we have Marcus Aurelius, who is perhaps the classic good emperor, but is it also the case here that that reputation is a bit too simplistic?
Yeah, I think with lots of historical characters, with humans, in fact, there's often, you know, we all have our good points and our bad points. I think it's certainly true that while Nero made many mistakes in his reign, Marcus Aurelius made far fewer mistakes as far as our historians are concerned. Also with Marcus Aurelius, it does depend to some extent on who you ask. So there was a tradition in a later period with the early Christians, so from about the 4th century onwards, of criticising Marcus Aurelius very severely, in fact, for the persecutions of the Christians that took place during his reign. So if you were to ask Eusebius what he thought of Marcus Aurelius, he may have put him, well, he did in fact put him in a series of persecutor emperors that started with Nero, and Marcus Aurelius was one of those emperors. However, our sources that talk about his reign from the pagan histories, I guess the classical histories, are generally much more positive about him, and he is the emperor who is both fair and has a good education, but also actually has to deal with quite a lot during his reign, including wars and coming into Italy of peoples from across the other side of the Rhine and of the Danube. But also he has to deal with plague as well during his reign. So he has quite a lot to contend with.
And actually, I was going to ask you about it later, but I could ask you now. The persecution of Christians is one of the things that Marcus Aurelius is criticised for nowadays. How kind of atypical was that? Were all the other emperors at this time persecuting Christians, or was this something that he was doing to a greater extent?
Yeah, so the important thing here is that to understand really the context of the persecution of Christians in this period, when we say persecution, we think generally of something sort of systematic, something empire-wide, perhaps something that meant all Christians across the empire needed to be scared for their lives. And that did happen during the Roman period, absolutely, that did happen, but not this early. So when we're talking about Marcus Aurelius in the sort of 160s, 170s CE, really what we have is local instances of persecution. And we had that before. After Nero, we have Domitian, and then also some problems under Trajan as well. So he's not, you know, unique in this at all. He's not the first after Nero to be having problems with what to do with Christians, as it were. But he is one emperor who had quite a few instances of those local persecutions during his reign in Asia Minor, so modern-day Turkey, but also in Gaul, so sort of France, modern-day France. So because there were more instances or more well recorded by the Christian authors instances during his reign, he is associated with that again in later Christian literature as well, as we might expect. And there was quite a few instances, like I say, during his reign. One of the earlier Christian sources, so I talked about Eusebius in the 4th century, but an earlier Christian source, Tertullian, so late 2nd, early 3rd century, he's a bit of an apologist for Marcus Aurelius. He says, well, these were local. He, you know, didn't really have necessarily an overview of what was happening. He wasn't saying to every local governor, yes, do that, was the way that Tertullian explains it. Our classical sources, by which I mean mainly Cassius Dio in terms of narrative history, doesn't mention it. So we don't have that particular perspective. But it's not something that's sort of systematic and empire-wide at this point, but it is, these local events are taking place and Christians are being punished and killed and in places during Marcus Aurelius's reign.
Now, so Marcus Aurelius, at the time he becomes emperor, emperors are not generally inheriting the throne from their father, are they? They're typically being adopted. So how does he first come into the line of succession then?
So during this period, which is sort of known as the adoptive emperors, which started with the Emperor Nerva in 96 CE, 96 CE, starting with Nerva, they were emperors who were adopted rather than succeeding because they were the sons of the previous emperors. Now it's tempting because of the way that sort of later historians have spoken about it to see this as a kind of, you know, a judgment call, as something that the emperors saw the you know, errors of previous dynasties and wanted to correct it. Actually, they just didn't have sons. And we see that with Marcus Aurelius, clearly, because when he does have a son who can take up the position of emperor, he does, have his own son as his heir. And actually, the relationship between the previous emperor, Antoninus Pius, and Marcus Aurelius is a close one. So Antoninus Pius is married to Marcus Aurelius's aunt. And also Marcus Aurelius is married to Antoninus Pius's daughter. So there is a family connection there. He's the previous emperor's son-in-law, in other words. So he's also adopted very early on by Antoninus Pius as well, as is his co-emperor Lucius Verus, the person who will become his co-emperor. So we do have a sense of sort of a family a connection there, both through the fact that Antoninus Pius is his sort of uncle-in-law, and also because he is married to Faustina. So he is the last of the adoptive emperors, because as I said, he names his son Commodus as heir. To succeed him when he dies. But we do have this period of Roman history where the emperors do tend to adopt rather than, but not necessarily because of, through choice.
And so Marcus Aurelius doesn't become emperor until he's, I think, around 40.
Yes.
So prior to that, how does he prepare, or how is he being prepared to reign?
Yeah, so he, as you say, becomes emperor when he's 40 in 161 CE. He was born in 121 CE. And he has been sort of picked out to go into that role since the death of the emperor before Antoninus Pius, which was Hadrian. When Hadrian dies, Antoninus Pius is still very young. He's still a teenager. But he has sort of been marked out, or his family have been marked out as one that should come into the line of succession. So Antoninus Pius adopts Marcus Aurelius as soon as Antoninus Pius becomes emperor, and Lucius Verus as well. So there is, right from that stage, right from that early point, an expectation of his succession to become emperor in due course. What he does is he moves in with Antoninus Pius, his adopted father, eventually, and he also sort of spends a lot of time with him. The letters that go between Marcus Aurelius and one of his tutors, Fronto, suggests that he has quite a close relationship with Antoninus Pius. They travel together. Antoninus Pius doesn't actually leave Italy during his reign. He very much likes to stay at home. And Marcus Aurelius is also very happy with that. They go off to different parts of Italy and spend days together. And you know, there's quite a close relationship there. He also is very close to his other family, his mother, his birth mother, as well as his sister. So we do have sort of a sense that he's living a life of where he's expecting to become emperor, but is living with his adopted father, but also paying quite close attention to his family and being a good son and a good brother as well.
Now, you've mentioned a couple of times that actually Marcus Aurelius is a joint emperor with Lucius Verus. You don't hear so much about Lucius Verus these days. Does that suggest that actually this wasn't an equal relationship and Marcus Aurelius was the dominant emperor, or actually were they quite equal?
Yeah, so Marcus Aurelius was older than Lucius Verus. So he was sort of dominant in that respect. He was sort of senior, I guess, in that respect when they both became emperor. The other thing is that Lucius Verus dies in 169 CE, so 8 years after they both become emperors. So Marcus Aurelius dies in 180, so he has the longer reign of the two as well, and of course has a much more prolific write up in the history books as well, you know, not only in antiquity but since then. Lucius Verus in some sources sort of acts as a counterpoint to Marcus Aurelius, which is interesting. If Marcus Aurelius is a wise sort of philosopher emperor, Lucius Verus, in one source, in Cassius Dio, is the warrior-like emperor. He's ready to go and deal with the problems that occur on the frontier. He is good, you know, with the military. He knows how to interact with soldiers. He's much better equipped. Cassius Dio says Marcus Aurelius is actually quite sickly, whereas Lucius Verus is younger and he's stronger and he's ready to go. The Historia Augusta, which is a later biography and not a particularly reliable biography, so we've got to kind of, you know, take a lot of what they say or what that the biographer says. Actually, they're claiming to be more than one person, but it is one person, what that biographer says, with a pinch of salt. But in that biography, in the characterization of Marcus Aurelius is more of someone who is a very good emperor. He is strong, he's not that ill. Lucius Verus is immoral and he doesn't know how to behave properly. He's sort of a bit like a Nero kind of character. He is too interested in the theatre, he's too interested in entertainments. And that's why Lucius Verus goes off in that first instance when there's problems in the frontier, because Marcus Aurelius thinks that that will help him to sort of rein in his luxurious side and his indulgences a little bit. So the same event happens. Lucius Verus goes off to the frontier in the east in right very early on in their reign. But the reason for it is very different in our two sources. Is he the younger, stronger man, better equipped, better, more of a military person? Or is he this immoral character who needs some sort of reform to take place? But he's certainly an interesting, co-emperor for Marcus Aurelius to act as a way of bringing out character of both of those people. But as you say, he's just not really been made as famous as Marcus Aurelius.
And when Marcus Aurelius and Lucius Verus come to power in 161 AD, what is the state of the Roman Empire? What are the most pressing concerns for them?
So at the same time as sort of Antoninus Pius dies and they Marcus Aurelius and Lucius Verus take over, there are some problems immediately in the east, on the eastern borders, with Parthia. And that's not a it's not a coincidence that that happens as there's a transition of power. That very transition is a weakness, is seen as a weakness. There's a new emperor or emperors in this case. They don't have very much military experience between them. In fact, Marcus Aurelius really has none at all. So the Parthian king used that as a good time to go into Armenia and put in his own king in place rather than the Roman client king. So that immediately needs to be dealt with, and that's when Lucius Verus goes off to the frontier to deal with that. He's there from the sort of early 160s to the mid. He comes back to Rome in 166 CE, having successfully dealt with the problem. And we hear, again, you know, we have the two different versions of Lucius Verus, if you like, but there is a letter from Fronto, that tutor, who was also a tutor to Lucius Verus, talking about how Lucius, you know, was very good with the soldiers. He was very good and organised. He got everybody sort of in the military ready, and that was why he was so successful in Parthia, and that he had those qualities. So it does seem that particular problem was... you know, dealt with it at that time. You know, it's going to recur again, and people are going to be sent out to Parthia again. But actually Marcus Aurelius, during the time when he is acting as a military emperor, is mainly focused on the north. So the Rhine and the Danube, and the people who are coming over from the other side of those territories and coming into Rome. And in particular, they make it to Italy, it seems, which is extraordinary and not happened for a very long time.
And actually, in the article that you've written for the magazine, you stress Marcus Aurelius's kind of warrior emperor credentials. So... How far do you see him as a kind of military commander, and how unusual was it for an emperor to be leading his troops at this time?
So he is perhaps best described, I think, as a reluctant military commander. I don't think it's necessarily how he imagined his reign would be, if, you know, he did imagine his reign as anything in particular. Antoninus Pius's reign had been so peaceful. They'd been able to stay in Italy. They hadn't had to go, you know, over to the borders. He hadn't had to really engage in that military side of things. But the emperor before Hadrian, so we've got Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, Antoninus Pius, then Marcus Aurelius, they're the five sort of adoptive emperors. Trajan was a very active military emperor, and he expanded the Roman Empire into Dacia, which again is one of those regions that is now becoming, you know, that they have to have some military presence in. And he also expanded further into Parthia as well. So he was a very active emperor in those terms, and he brought a lot of wealth into Rome. We've got Trajan's Column, of course, and you know, accounts of huge spectacles that took place because of his successes. 123 days of games in the Colosseum, for example, when he takes Dacia. So Trajan is the archetypal sort of military emperor, and is described by his contemporaries, trying perhaps to flatter him, as the best emperor, the Optimus Princeps. So he is sort of the paradigm of everything that an emperor could be. Marcus Aurelius is, to some extent, affected by that, because part of what he is doing is defending some of those territories and having to deal with problems in those similar areas, the north and in the east. But also, there would have been, you know, a way, if he wanted to, of not having gone to war. He didn't have to lead his troops from the front. Other emperors hadn't. Trajan had, which set a precedent to some extent. But he could have perhaps bowed out and just let generals do their work. Other emperors had done that quite successfully. But he did seem to want to go to the front and be involved in the battles and be commanding the troops. So that was perhaps because he felt he should, as an emperor. He wasn't willing to shirk that responsibility, perhaps. But it was it has sort of marked his reign. It does mean that the majority, actually, of his reign, over half, was spent on campaign and not in Rome.
And how successful was he as a military commander? Was he able to retain the territories that Trajan had conquered?
So those territories had already started slipping, really. So it was more of his war was defensive to begin with, as you say. And he managed to do that quite successfully. So he did manage to defend Italy, for example, and he did manage to make deals with the different peoples who had come over, the Marcomanni, the Quadi, and others. There's a lot of diplomacy talked about, actually, in our sources, as well as, you know, sort of, you know, the actual fighting. there seem to have been relatively few pitched battles in Marcus Aurelius's military experience. And for that, the sort of sources I'm using are things like Marcus Aurelius's column. So he had his own column, which showed the wars that he had on the northern frontiers, which do show very bloody battles and really violent and horrific scenes. So there was a great deal of that going on. But also, like I say, we hear about the diplomacy, about letting particular people settle in particular places, and also the breakdown of diplomacy when things go wrong, when treaties are broken. Marcus Aurelius can sometimes act in quite a strong and, our sources say, uncharacteristic way. At one point, he asks for a leader of an enemy to be brought to him for a large amount of money. And if they bring him decapitated, they'll get slightly less money, but that's still okay to bring him decapitated. He really, has a problem with this particular person. So there was a great deal of violence. There was a great deal of bloodshed. But he does seem to have been successful in that violence, in that bloodshed, because he does do a good defensive job in his reign. And he's also seems to be going on the offensive towards the end of the 170s. So there's an idea that he might try and start to take some of the territory back and go on the offensive. But his death in 180 puts a stop to that.
And considering he spent so much time on campaign, was he able to achieve much on what you might call the domestic front?
Yeah, so our sources talk about how when he is in Rome, the short periods where he can come to Rome, he is brilliant at administration. He is able to sit and hear court cases. He can he sorts out any problems that are have arisen in Rome. He makes sure that he spends time with the people and gives generous gifts to the people, as well as the senators and the equestrians. So he is a very good administrator according to the sources, and that's how he spends the majority of the beginning of his reign. So that idea that Lucius Verus goes off and fights the wars and Marcus Aurelius stays in Rome and deals with actually running Rome seems to work quite well. And it's, of course, the death of Lucius Verus and also more threats of the enemies coming closer to Italy that put a stop to that. So there's an idea he could have been sort of the most successful administrative emperor, as it were, if he'd had chosen to do that. But when he is able to be in Rome, he is very well liked and seems to keep all the different groups in Roman society on side.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
So he says at the end of the letter, "Farewell, most loving, most delightful and eloquent man, my sweetest master. When you see the unfermented wine seething in the cask, let it remind you that my longing for you is welling up in just the same way in my breast and overflowing and foaming. Fare ever well."
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
And now the thing that Marcus Aurelius is probably best known for today is his philosophical writings. Mm-hmm. And he was influenced, I believe, strongly by the Stoic belief system. So what were kind of the key tenets of Marcus Aurelius's philosophy?
So we have a text written by Marcus Aurelius, the Meditations, which is a sort of a philosophical treatise. It's a notebook, really. It's him kind of writing down a sort of personal diary, a personal notebook of things, of ways to live, of philosophical maxims. So there are quotes from other philosophers in there as well. But just a guide to being a good person. He is thinking about a guide to being a good ruler, not necessarily for other people, but for himself, and what that would require. And also it includes some of the things that he thinks are the best qualities of people that he's known. So in book one of the meditations, he talks about family members and his tutors, and he says, this is what I've learned from them. Book one is really the only book that has a sort of structure like that. The rest of it is notes on different themes. So when he's writing the meditations, he is talking a lot about ways of being the best person you can be, I think is the way to put it. A way to live your life that means you are kind and fair and just and treat people in the way that you might like to be treated. These are all clearly good qualities to live by. And he uses, you know, the philosophical thought to help that. He uses, like you say, Stoic principles, other principles as well. He quotes other schools of philosophy too. He does seem to be most strongly influenced by the Stoics and to be thinking about the universe in Stoic terms. So a sort of divine reason that everyone is attached to, and then you have your own governing body, governing mind, really, that you should use to, like I say, be the best person you can be. But he says things like, you know, don't judge others. You should be able to lift yourself above that, because actually, what does judging do? If you are judging other people, you are making certain decisions about their behaviour, which are not yours to make. And it's never going to do you any good. It's only going to cause you harm. So just don't do it. Just step away and don't put yourself in that sort of situation. So that's the sort of thing that the meditations is full of. And he repeats themes like ethical behavior. He also talks a lot about death, because that was clearly a reality of his life, as both as a soldier, emperor, as someone who is fighting wars, but also back in terms of his family. He has at least 13 children, a lot of whom die before they can reach adulthood. So he's constantly having to deal with these this sort of infant mortality, the loss of children in particular. And he does write about that. He writes about not getting too attached to your children, for example. When you kiss them goodnight, think that they could be dead in the morning. That's a reality of life. So there are some darker notes in the meditations as well as, like I say, a sort of guide to living the best life that you can.
Were these meditations intended for posterity? Did he think these would form part of his legacy, or were they really just something he was writing privately for himself?
Yeah, they seem more private, I think. I don't think he necessarily expected us to be talking about them in 2021. Actually, one of the points that he makes in his meditations is you should focus on what you do now. Don't think about posterity, because when you die, you know, your reputation will die not much longer after you. If you're lucky enough to have a reputation, it's not going to last very long. So focus on living well now. Don't think about posterity. So he might be quite surprised that we're still talking about the meditations this long after. But they weren't actually well known in antiquity, or known as far as we know. They became popular, or became part something that people knew again, sort of in the Byzantine period. So 8th, 9th, 10th centuries, we see them sort of coming up again. There are a few references earlier on than that, but not sort of, you know, we don't get Cassius Dio, for example, or even the biographer in the Historia Augusta talking about the meditations. They do seem to have been a more private notebook that, you know, was preserved because of who Marcus Aurelius was. But he certainly wasn't the only emperor to write. We have mentions of other things emperors wrote in the histories as well. So treatises on particular things or you know, satirical pamphlets. Nero quite liked writing poems, scurrilous poems about people. So some not scurrilous, some lovely poems as well. the idea of emperors writing is there in the histories. It's just this is one that we have, which is great.
But is the idea of an emperor having this kind of philosophical bent, is that unusual, or is it just because it happens to survive in his case?
So it does seem that Marcus Aurelius was particularly interested in philosophy. So Antoninus Pius was as well. One of the main praises that Marcus Aurelius gives Antoninus Pius in Book One of the Meditations is that he was a very keen philosopher, that he had a very keen interest in the subject and that he knew his philosophy really well. The education of Marcus Aurelius seems to have made him particularly interested in this. Of course, the idea of engaging with philosophy is there, like I say, for Antoninus Pius too. There are other aspects of sort of education that other emperors engage with. So again, not to harp on about Nero, but he was, you know, very interested in poetry and you know, writing poetry and that sort of thing. He was very interested in the Greek language. He liked to speak in the Greek language if he was addressing particular people. So there was that element of culture, I guess, in other emperors that we see as well coming through. But certainly we don't have anything like the philosophical ideas in the meditations necessarily coming through any other of our sources.
And can we see much evidence of Marcus Aurelius actually reigning in accordance with the philosophical principles he wrote about? And how much did he live up to his own ideals?
Yeah, so this is a very interesting question. And I guess it's one of those where what's good about the meditations, what the meditations actually is a set of principles that can be moulded, that you can adapt to particular situations and adopt in particular situations, of living sort of the best way that you can, whatever that best way is. So part of Stoic philosophy as well is being able to live whilst, you know, being involved in the politics, for example, of running the empire. Seneca is another very famous Stoic philosopher who was an advisor to Caligula and then an advisor, or tutor, sorry, to Caligula and then an advisor to Nero. So very well connected in the imperial family. Marcus Aurelius is doing that, I think. He is taking the ideas of living a life well but adapting that to different situations. So living your life well might be going out, in the context of being Roman emperor, might be going out and brutally killing many of the enemy. And that is perhaps harder for us to square up because we sometimes get the idea of Marcus Aurelius as an emperor who sat in his study and, you know, just wrote and read and, you know, administered justice very fairly, which, of course, you know, he did. That's sort of perhaps more characteristic of the beginning of his reign. But when he needed to, go and go to war, he was able to do that as well. So perhaps the versatility of his philosophical ideas and the way that he approached being emperor helps to give a bit of an idea that he didn't necessarily let Stoicism rule the way that he conducted himself, but it does seem that he just tried to conduct himself in a way that was appropriate to each situation.
And you mentioned earlier Marcus Aurelius's successor, Commodus, who history generally doesn't record as kindly as his father. I mean, is Marcus Aurelius in any way responsible for the fact that his son's reign is something of a disaster?
Yeah, so this is, of course, difficult to get away from Commodus after Gladiator, which is a wonderful film, but paints him in a very particular kind of way. And, you know, our sources also are not big fans of Commodus. Cassius Dio, in fact, is a senator during the reign of Commodus. So he has firsthand experience and talks about that in his histories of being a senator under Commodus. Our sources try to some extent to separate Marcus Aurelius from Commodus. So some say that Faustina, Marcus Aurelius's wife, had an affair. This child can't possibly be Marcus Aurelius's child. There are other sordid stories about gladiators and there's a particularly horrible story in the Historia Augusta, which is, I don't think, is particularly reliable. And even then, it's sort of talked about as a bit of a rumour that Faustina was particularly attracted to a gladiator at one stage. And in order to you know, have a son, to make a son, to have a son to be an heir, an oracle told Marcus Aurelius that they should kill this gladiator and basically copulate in a bath of the gladiator's blood. And that's why Commodus then has this obsession with gladiators and fighting in the gladiatorial arena. So you can see how the sources are trying their best to sort of come up with reasons why, trying to be salacious as well, are coming up with reasons why these two people could possibly be related, how such a good emperor could have a child that was such a bad emperor. But Commodus, is to some extent groomed, to the extent that you can be, I guess, when with Marcus Aurelius being away on campaign. In 175 CE, there's a revolt against Marcus Aurelius. So general in Syria leads a revolt. His name's Avidius Cassius. And at that stage, Marcus Aurelius is a bit afraid of what might happen to Commodus if he's left alone in Rome. So he brings him out, to the military camp, introduces him to all the soldiers and, you know, gets him familiar with that scenario. Then when Avidius Cassius is defeated, Marcus Aurelius goes back to Rome for a couple of years. And it's at that stage that Commodus is raised to a sort of co-emperor with Marcus Aurelius to try and give him a bit of training. There's partly the fact that Marcus Aurelius, of course, would have been away a lot, as it were. He was on campaign a lot. But Commodus is also his own character, I guess. He has his own way of thinking about the principate, of thinking about what it is to be an emperor. And I think that has a lot to do with the way that Roman emperors are characterised. These people did, of course, have very different ideas. Marcus Aurelius clearly had particular ideas to do with, ethics and philosophy and doing particular things. He did go out to the frontiers. He did kill people, you know, that all of that. But Commodus probably had a very different idea of what he wanted to be as an emperor, as, you know, Nero did compared to Augustus, as Caligula had a very different idea of what it was to be an emperor as well, and the autocracy that an emperor could have. So there is an element of that, I think, and our historians like some models of being an emperor and dislike others, as you would expect.
So we're recording this and it's nearly the 1900th birthday of Marcus Aurelius, who and nowadays, you know, you can find his philosophical quotes on posters, on tea towels, anywhere you'd care to look. Do you think if he was kind of alive now and he saw how his reputation was nearly 2,000 years later, do you think he'd be somewhat surprised the way we view him today?
I think he'd be surprised he's still viewed today. Like I said, from the meditations, he's very clear that when you die, your reputation will not last long. That seems to be the way that he thinks about the relationship between life, death and posterity. So I think the idea that we are got all of these little fragments of different things and are trying to piece them all together to give him a biography, to give him an idea of his life, might be slightly surprising. He also might be quite surprised at the fact that we have letters still between him and his tutor, one of his tutors. So he would have had about 18 tutors as a young boy and as a young adult. And one of them was a man named Fronto. He was his tutor in Latin oratory. And we do have some of the letters now. They were discovered in the 19th century between Marcus Aurelius and Fronto, also between Fronto and Lucius Verus and Antoninus Pius as well. And that, you know, is another interesting part of his life that you know, to some extent contradicts the meditations. In the meditations, he's thinking about, you know, ideals and ethics and ways of living and detachment from people, you know, being detached from your children to some extent, being detached from, things that are going to cause you pain. Whereas in the letters, a lot of them are, you know, writing to Fronto about medical illnesses. So, you know, I hear your daughter is sick. How is she? You know, I hear you are sick. You know, what's going on? You know, how bad is your mucus? Those kinds of things. And they're quite, you know, they get quite explicit in medical terms. But they also show, so the other side of that sort of detachment of Marcus Aurelius that we get through the meditations, they also show a very loving relationship between Marcus Aurelius and Fronto in a way that, you know, can sometimes surprise people. So I have an example of how, if you don't mind, how he signs off not all of his letters, but one of his letters that I think is you know, sums up perhaps some of the excessive way in which he tries to show his love for his tutor. So he says at the end of the letter, "Farewell, most loving, most delightful and eloquent man, my sweetest master. When you see the unfermented wine seething in the cask, let it remind you that my longing for you is welling up in just the same way in my breast and overflowing and foaming. Fare ever well." So, you know, it's quite emotional. lots of these letters are quite emotional in the way that he talks about Fronto, about how much he loves him, about the relationship they have as tutor and pupil. And that remains even when Marcus Aurelius becomes emperor. You know, he still refers to Fronto as you know, to master. He still refers to him as his teacher. So there is a, you know, a nice kind of counter way of viewing some of the more tea towel like quotes from the meditations. But I think, you know, he would possibly be surprised that we're still reading the letters between him and his tutor in 2021.
That was Sushma Malik. As I mentioned earlier, you can read her piece on Marcus Aurelius in the June issue of BBC History magazine, which is on sale now and also includes articles on Anglo-Saxon Christianity, the AIDS crisis, the life of Prince Philip, and a whole lot more. And if you'd like to hear more from Sushma, she also recorded an episode on Roman emperors for our Everything You Wanted to Know series a few weeks ago. You can find that in our back catalogue or go to historyextra.com and search for Roman emperors. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. We'll be back on Friday with an episode on Napoleon's art theft.